content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or printing impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the December 1st, 2025 issue of the New Yorker, Where Dante Guides Us. The Divine Comedy, the poet's tour of the Christian afterlife, is filled with strikingly modern touches and a poetic energy rooted in the imperfectly human, by Claudia Roth Pierrepont. During a stolen hour in the spring of 1944, when Primo Levi had been a slave laborer at Auschwitz for about 3 months, a French prisoner asked Levi to teach him some Italian. Levi, a young chemist from Turin, went on to become a major chronicler of life in the camps. But at the time, he didn't believe that he had what it took to survive. He thought too much. He was hollow with hunger and painfully aware that his hands were covered in sores and that he smelled. Worse of all, he felt that the things he'd seen would leave him dead inside, even if he did survive. It would have been natural to give up. He didn't understand initially why a part of the Divine Comedy came to mind in that furtive hour of teaching. It was hardly Italian conversation 101. But Dante's story of the Greek warrior Ulysses began to spill out of him. He forgot many lines, but persevered, sometimes translating into French, determined to make his fellow prisoner understand, especially the speech in which Ulysses urges a worn-out group of sailors, finally safe ashore, to go back out to sea. Consider well the seed that gave you birth. You were not made to live your lives as brutes, but to be followers of worth and knowledge. Levi recalled that he seemed to be hearing the lines for the first time, and that they sounded like the voice of God. For a moment, he forgot where he was. Dante's Ulysses is the same mythical figure as Homer's Odysseus, and Dante's portrait shares much of the character's familiar background. A hero of the Trojan War, he's known for his craftiness, shown most famously in his idea that the Trojans might just fall for the gift of an enormous wooden horse secretly packed with soldiers. It's after the Greeks have won the war, thanks largely to this brilliant ruse, that Homer and Dante radically diverge. In the Odyssey, Homer tells the story of Odysseus's long return home. The voyage is full of stops and hesitations, but he resists the greatest lures in order to return to wife and son, father and homeland. Going home, that's what the whole desperate voyage is about. But it's possible that Dante knew a different version of the story. He didn't read Greek, and at the time he was writing, in the early 14th century, Homer had yet to be properly translated into Latin, let alone Italian. Then, too, any version with a happy homecoming simply wasn't the story Dante needed to tell. His Ulysses is an adventurer with an insatiable appetite for knowledge and experience. Though his family is waiting at home, he chooses to remain at sea and to sail beyond the accepted limit of human navigation, the Strait of Gibraltar. Remember, this was written nearly 200 years before Columbus, into an empty ocean and dangers unknown. The speech he makes to the ragged remnant of his men, a portion of which appears above in Alan Mandelbaum's translation, is filled with pride and aspiration. Levi, like many others, found Ulysses' speech to be a sustaining example of the human spirit unshackled. And yet, Ulysses brings about the death of all his men, who, having been persuaded, follow their leader and are drowned in a furious storm. More, the whirlwind that takes them under is no mere accident, but the act of a wrathful god. The speech is a key reason that Dante's Ulysses is damned to a hell even worse than Levi's, because it is eternal. The Divine Comedy, conceived as a guided tour of the Christian afterlife, is written in three volumes corresponding to the realms that greet all human souls after their brief embodiment on earth: Inferno, or Hell, Purgatory, and Paradise. The author, Dante Alighieri, born in Florence in 1265, is also its leading character. Not a warrior as in the Homeric epics or their Latin successor, Virgil's Aeneid, but rather a poet, a flawed and introspective man whose fall into despair sets the drama in motion. Is Dante experiencing a crisis of faith? Or, in today's terms, a midlife crisis of direction? He tells us that he is halfway through his life. Is he having trouble imagining the epic poem that he aspires to write? All these problems, bound together, begin to be solved when Virgil appears in the dark wood where Dante finds himself, leading him past dangers that have blocked his path. Or, more precisely, the shade of Virgil appears, since he lived in the age of Emperor Augustus and has been dead for some 1,300 years. The great Roman poet inspired Dante in many ways, and in the Divine Comedy, Virgil is wise, kind, protective. He becomes like a father to the often bewildered younger poet, leading him from the mouth of hell to its core, and then back up, through purgatory and to the brink of paradise. There, Virgil must cede his duty to another. As a pagan who died before the time of Christ, and was therefore incapable of true faith, he can't set foot in paradise, and must return to his assigned place in the divine scheme. He too, it turns out, the dearest figure in Dante's vastly buzzing world, a sort of antique Polonius or Dumbledore, is doomed to pass eternity in a subdivision of hell. There is no physical torture in this place, called Limbo, and the conversation is presumably exceptional. Homer, Horace, and Ovid are among the other virtuous pagans we glancingly meet there. But this is not to say that Virgil doesn't suffer from being denied salvation. For him, limbo remains a dark prison because it shuts out forever and without hope the light of God. Even to Dante, the rules seem confusingly unfair. Hell, clearly the most violent of the realms, makes for the most exuberantly entertaining of the books, filled with action, fantastical monsters, and occasional farce. One well-named devil, Malacota, Evil Tail, summons his posse with enormous farts that make a trumpet of his ass. Above all, it's filled with human stories. Dante, the character called Dante, moves through its nine ever-worsening circles like a reporter, drawing tales out of miserable souls by promising to preserve their names and stories back on Earth. He is the rarest of creatures, a living visitor, and he's taking mental notes. Virgil, in a strikingly modern touch, persuades a terrifying giant who serves as a sort of elevator system between infernal levels to let them down gently, telling him that Dante the writer, can make him famous. Hell is nevertheless filled with bloody and horrific torments. In Dante's eyes, some sinners fully deserve what they get. Corrupt clerics, for example, including a pope, are jammed upside down into holes in the rocky earth, legs flailing and feet licked by fire. There are a notable number of churchmen in hell, also Florentines. At other times, he pities the souls he meets and is chastised by Virgil for it. To feel pity is to question the judgment of God, for Satan has no power here. He himself suffers at hell's lowest level, bound in ice. It is God who has sentenced unrepentant sinners to this place and designed ingenious torments to echo their crimes. So, adulterous lovers are battered by fierce winds that whirl them around in each other's arms, mimicking the turbulent passion they did not control. Fortune tellers, those who claim to know what only God can know, have their heads twisted backward so that they can see nothing but what is behind them. and Ulysses, silver-tongued persuader of men, is encased in a tongue of flame. Yet, however justly these transgressors are condemned, they draw not only Dante's sympathy, but ours, too, luring us into the uneasy position of doubting divine justice. Going beyond boundaries, daring everything for knowledge, Dante's Ulysses has much in common with mankind's faulty prototype, Adam, whom Dante eagerly interrogates in Paradise. Question: how long did you live in the garden before biting the apple? Answer: about 7 hours. He also has much in common with Dante himself in the poet's sheer gall in taking on this work, entering forbidden territories, exploring the worst and the best of man, trying to penetrate the mind of God. And, although he can't let go of nagging qualms or dangerous questions, he gives the readers who are persuaded by his silver tongue fair warning. "Turn back if you would see your shores again," Dante cautions us. "The seas I sail were never sailed before." Homer was not one person, it is now generally agreed, but a slowly accumulating oral tradition given a name. Virgil's Aeneid breaks off suddenly, apparently unfinished, and at his death the poet is said to have asked that the manuscript be burned. Dante Alighieri, the successor to these civilization-defining literary forces, was born to a family of moderate means in an Italian city torn by political violence and in an era when the rebirth of classical learning had barely begun. He was a contemporary and possibly an acquaintance of the great Florentine painter Giotto, whom he mentions in the comedy for having seized attention from Cimabue, Giotto's former master, who produced images of icon-like rigidity, much as Dante himself will overtake the writers of his youth. Here, in two different arts, is the moment when medieval severity gives way to physical and psychological nuance, when human figures stretch their limbs and take breath. Within a generation, Boccaccio would write that Dante had opened the way for the long-absent muses to return to Italy. He was ambitious from the start. Prue Shaw, in her new book, Dante, The Essential Commedia, emphasizes the exceptional importance and nobility that Dante accords the vocation of the poet, and how, from early on, he believed his powers to be equal to those of the great poets of classical antiquity. His early writing reflected the popular style of the French troubadours, courtly poet-musicians who sang of their longing for a beautiful lady. In his case, the beloved was the unobtainable Beatrice Portinari, a wealthy banker's daughter whom Dante claimed to have loved from their first meeting, when both were children. A bit of charming self-mythology, and steadily on until her untimely death at 24. It did not seem to matter that he saw her rarely or that both were married off to others for financial and political reasons. The Divine Comedy has nothing to say about Dante's wife or their four children. Beatrice was the love that fueled his poems, which only became more spiritual after her death, when her very name, which suggests beatitude, becomes for him a form of prayer. If poetry made Dante's life, politics overturned it. In 1300, in his mid-30s, he served on a Florentine governing committee that exiled several leaders of two clashing political factions in a bid for peace. The following year, while Dante was on a diplomatic mission to Rome, his own faction back home was ousted, and he was falsely accused of corruption. He found himself exiled from Florence in absentia, and in 1302, he was sentenced to burn at the stake should he ever return. For the rest of his life, nearly 20 years, he sought refuge in various Italian cities, with their unfamiliar dialects and local cultures, nursing both a bitterness and a longing that are felt in the epic work he undertook. He probably started writing it in about 1307. But he set the poem, very deliberately, before his exile, at Easter in the year 1300. He called it simply the comedy, meaning a work that begins in darkness, but, unlike a tragedy, ends in light. The adjective divine was added by a printer more than 200 years later, reflecting both the work's subject matter and its status. Classical mythology, ancient and medieval history, Christian theology, astronomy, morality, Aristotelian philosophy, monks and nuns and whores and forgers and blasphemers and poets, purgatory is full of poets, all are contained in a rhyme scheme of Dante's invention and in the Tuscan dialect that was the only home remaining to him. Three books comprising 100 chapter-like cantos, the Latin-derived word, a tribute to the poetry's deep musical origins. 14,233 lines. Not in Latin, it must be emphasized, the language of erudition and prestige, the obvious choice for an epic work, but in a language that ordinary people spoke and that, as he said, even women could read. Illiterates would have heard it recited. There are 14th century tales of blacksmiths and garbage collectors rattling off passages by heart. But how many people, even then, could make out the references? The need for a supplemental commentary, footnotes, was recognized by one of the earliest Dante scholars, Dante's son, Jacopo, soon after the poet's death, when the ink on Paradise was barely dry. By the end of the 14th century, the list of commentaries was long. To read what has accumulated now would be a career. So how does one enter this overwhelming work? There is no single perfect or even agreed-upon English translation, although there are dozens of them. It's been adapted in prose, blank verse, and close imitations of terza rima, Dante's distinctive three-line scheme, in which the first and third line of every verse rhyme with each other, while the second line loops forward like a threaded needle to stitch the rhyme of the next verse into place. And onward ad infinitum, creating a springing momentum that feels natural in Italian, with its plenitude of words that rhyme on the final syllable, but is impossible to capture without strain in English, a language that wearied translators described as rhyme poor. One must salute the translators who continue to devote stretches of their lives to this 700-year-old poem, pledging to a mad voyage of their own, determined to make readers understand the love that drives them. And one must not blame them if, in an age of shrunken attention spans, they become a bit desperate. Shaw's book takes a novel approach. The Essential Commedia isn't a standard translation, but a radically abridged version of the text, with chunks of the poem, in Italian and in Shaw's translation, set like jewels into a running commentary made up of narrative bridges, historical context, interpretation, and occasional witty asides. It all fits into one volume, and, though the original's momentum is undone, Shaw, a first-rate British Dante scholar, provides a momentum of her own. If it's a cheat, it's also an open invitation to new readers. And it gets better as it goes along, since so much less assistance is needed in the packed storytelling of Inferno than in the theological vagaries of Paradise, which have been known to stop some readers cold. Shaw repeatedly clarifies the most dense and taxing paradisial discussions, from an explanation of the dark spots on the moon to an account of the moment of creation. Yet Shaw herself is nearly transparent. Try to speak of what she's done, and you speak only of Dante. The poet Mary Jo Bang's Divine Comedy, recently completed after some 20 years with the publication of Paradiso, isn't a standard translation either. It's closer to an improvisation, filled with references to movies and rock and jazz albums, which veer far from the Italian and are meant to draw new readers by making Dante our contemporary. Led Zeppelin, Charles Mingus, Cyndi Lauper, and The Wizard of Oz, to name a few, contribute lyrics and phrases that appear in the scholarly, if sometimes wryly po-faced, footnotes. Bang calls her work a colloquial version, and it can admittedly be jarring to hear Virgil sound like a slacker. "What's up with you?" he asked Dante, who had just had a vision of the martyrdom of St. Stephen. "That you can't keep it together?" Yet this may be something of the effect that Dante sought in using the common language that he loved, in part for the way it changed. Bang does better with the grotesquerie of hellfire, where lowballing the tone can have a sharp, often comic, edge. And she sometimes lands a line with stinging freshness. In the very fine traditional translation I usually reach for by Robert and Jean Hollander, the demonic ferryman Charon warns you wicked souls, whom he is transporting to hell, to give up hope of ever seeing heaven. And then there's Bang. "Give it up, you scum uncles," Charon growls. "You'll never see the sky again." Language may change, but people don't. And the mirror Dante holds up has made him a constant contemporary. Purgatory, the middle realm, is a place where sinners who have repented, even right before dying, even if only in their thoughts, are sent to be cleansed before ascending to paradise. It has no direct biblical source, but became church doctrine in Dante's time, providing hope to those who feared that they weren't worthy of paradise. Dante situates it on a mountain rising out of an empty sea. On its seven terraces, people suffer torments not for the sake of punishment, but to be cured of their predilection for however many of the seven deadly sins, pride, envy, lust, etc., they've committed. Depending on your nature, you may be able to skip a terrace or two. Nobody skips pride, so don't bother pretending to be above it. The lessons are harsh. The envious have their eyes sewn shut with iron wire. Still, in contrast with hell, there is the promise of getting out. Time passes. Prayers from pious souls on earth can shorten your sentence, and the church was busy developing other sorts of pardons, too, for cash. A professor who currently teaches a course about Dante to prisoners says that purgatory is their favorite part. Some of the most defining writers of the modern age were fixated on the idea of Dante as a contemporary, and their recognition points up the poet's unorthodoxies. To the circles of hell, for example, he added a realm of sinners of his own invention, those who never make a true commitment to a cause, who live without disgrace, yet without praise, and are confined, plagued by wasps and stinging flies, with the angels who took no side when Lucifer made war on God. Dante had certainly hated this type in life. The shock here is how many of these indifferent souls there are. "I had not thought death had undone so many," T.S. Eliot wrote in The Wasteland, using Dante's realization to transpose a scene of medieval hell to 20th century London, where crowds of commuters move dully through brown morning fog, their eyes fixed just beyond their feet, as if they too will never see the sky again. And just outside the gates of purgatory, near the base of the mountain, Dante comes upon an old friend called Balacqua, lounging in the shade of a boulder. An indolent procrastinator, he explains that, because he waited to repent until his life was nearly over, he must now wait for as many years as he lived before purgation can begin. So why move at all? Bang, showing a little trouble with the rules of purgatory and with math, projects that he will have to wait 21,000 years, a period that Samuel Beckett would likely have found pleasing. Beckett was an assiduous reader of Dante and put Balacqua into his fiction many times, starting in the story Dante and the Lobster with Balacqua Schwa, a lazy young Dubliner who is studying Dante and learns firsthand about compassion for the damned. Why not piety and pity both, even down below, he worries. For Beckett, Balacqua was a key to our condition as much as Ulysses was for Primo Levi. He seems to walk straight into Beckett's uncanny world, along with a small compendium of Dante's other sorry souls, the ones half buried in mud and excrement in tombs, all determined to speak, made recognizably modern by the omission of cause or purpose in their plight. Dante's compassion for Virgil grows as they near the point where the older poet must leave the younger behind. In purgatory, Dante has seen pagan souls who are saved, and he will see more in paradise. Exceptions that make Virgil's fate even more inexplicably harsh. After persevering through all seven terraces, master and pupil emerge at the top of the mountain, which, in Dante's sacred geography, is the location of the Garden of Eden, the last cleansing stop before paradise. Together, they watch a fully costumed procession of the church triumphant, with flying banners and choral hallelujahs. Dante turns to Virgil, who returns his look of amazement, culminating in a chariot carrying the long-sought Beatrice veiled in white. Commentators often claim that Beatrice represents faith and Virgil reason. Virgil himself has warned that reason can't access the upper realms. It is Beatrice who will lead Dante there. Still, Dante is unprepared. Seeing Beatrice, he feels the rising flame of a very human love. He turns once more to tell Virgil about it, but Virgil is gone. And in the Garden of Eden, where the woman he's yearned for stands before him and insists that everyone in this place is always happy, he cannot stop weeping. Dante's journey began, he tells us, early on in Inferno, because the Virgin Mary wanted to save him from the dangers of the dark wood. We can't know for certain why he was singled out, but it can be inferred, from what he is a saint tell Beatrice, that the Virgin admired his poems, specifically the spiritually elevated love poems devoted to Beatrice. It is because of his art that he is led through hell, purgatory, and finally paradise. He will see God's universe, and he will write a book that makes others see it too. The show put on for him in the upper realm is spectacular. Brilliant lights, aerial dancing, music, all spread across the moon and the planets, where he and Beatrice travel, going past the stars to God's own home in the Empyrean. Dante is dazzled, but, as readers have long noted, he does not seem entirely comfortable. Spectacle is hard to make compelling in writing. So are long speeches about religion or astronomy. He prays to Apollo for inspiration, which seems theologically unsound and has tied centuries of scholars into knots. But it's Dante's lapses and struggles that infuse this rigidly triumphant final sphere with enlivening consciousness and tension. He asks too many questions. Why couldn't God forgive mankind without resorting to the crucifixion? Why has a particular saint been chosen for a given task? One exasperated saint explains that the answers are beyond human comprehension, adding that when Dante returns to earth, he should dissuade people from such questioning. This is one bit of heavenly advice he does not take. Beatrice provides little of Virgil's reassuring warmth. However beautiful, she is unexpectedly stern, austere, and doctrine-driven. She's been referred to as Thomas Aquinas in drag. Given to phrases like, in my infallible opinion, she reminds Dante of a military leader. She's initially hard on him because the rules require that he confess his sinning ways, chiefly, it seems, in the matter of his interest in another woman after Beatrice's death, or possibly in other women, the Italian being judiciously unclear. But her mission has always been to keep him true to the higher path. If this devoutness doesn't come easy to him, that's the point, conveyed with surprising humor and accumulating force. By some Dantean law, Beatrice's physical beauty increases as the two move closer to God, and he can't look at anything but her. Turn around and listen, because paradise isn't only in my eyes, she instructs. For Dante, though, the flesh has become the way to the spirit. His first sight of God is as a point of light reflected in those eyes. By the time Dante began writing Paradise in about 1317, he was in his early 50s and had been exiled from Florence for some 15 years. He lived for a welcome period under steady patronage in Verona, but moved to Ravenna in his later years at the invitation of its ruler. There's reason to think that he would have further polished his final volume had he had more time. But it's also true that his poetic energies were rooted in the imperfectly human, in the experience of daily life. At one point, he is told about his coming exile. "You will leave behind everything you love most dearly," the prophecy begins. And in Shaw's translation, "You will experience how salty is the taste of another man's bread, and how hard a road it is to go up and down another man's stairs." His first reaction is fear that, without a home and the protection of a government, he won't have the courage to tell the truth about powerful figures and risk exposure to their revenge. But in Paradise, he's told he must speak anyway. "Open your mouth." This is advice he takes. The Divine Comedy is a work of political courage, from its willing antagonism of the families of the damned who are named in Inferno, to the greater targets of Paradise, where Dante clearly felt that he had nothing left to lose. Here, residents of heaven, including Thomas Aquinas and Saint Benedict, variously denounce the state of the Dominican, Franciscan, and Benedictine orders. Saint Peter rails against the greed and the political intrigues of the contemporary papacy, which have turned the church into a sewer of blood and stench. The city of Florence is condemned, too. Once a modest and well-mannered republic, it's now corrupted by wealth and vulgar display. Except for hell, it's the place that Dante seems to hate most. And, excepting Paradise, it's the place he most wants to be. In a startlingly personal aside at the opening of a late canto, he speaks about the lean years he has spent writing the poem and his hopes for the completed work. He doesn't speak of spreading knowledge of God's magnificent and moral universe, although this has been his charge and remains an important goal. He doesn't speak of literary immortality, although this, too, is certainly important, if covertly so, being the wrong kind of immortality. He speaks instead of contemporary fame, a triumph so resounding that the Florentines will publicly repent his cruel exile and ask him to return, crowning him with laurel in the baptistery where he was christened. "I shall return a poet." Dante died in 1321 in Ravenna and was laid to rest in a plain stone tomb. But other hopes came to pass over the years, along with achievements and repercussions he could not have imagined. Because of Dante, by the 19th century, the Tuscan dialect had become the Italian language. The popes began to claim him as their own. Politically, his thought was broad enough to be used in support of radically opposed ideas. The American abolitionist Charles Sumner cited Dante on the damnation of those who never fought for a cause. Teddy Roosevelt used the same passages to try to push the United States into the First World War. Mussolini twisted phrases from the poem to justify fascist racial laws. For a man of his era, always a worrisome qualification, Dante seems remarkably free of prejudice against the Jewish people and religion. And there is a panoply of Old Testament figures in Paradise. He was harder on the Muslim religion, which he regarded as a schismatic breakaway from Christianity, a medieval position used by recent right-wing Italian politicians to champion a purely Christian Italian state. Bang, in her introduction to Paradiso, points to Dante's political relevance in our own country, at a time when partisan warfare is as destructive as in the era he decried. Politics may be as good a way as any to enter the poem. Come for the corrupt politicians boiling in pitch, stay for the poetry and the spellbinding stories. Among the newly arrived souls on the shores of purgatory, Dante meets another old friend, a musician who greets him eagerly. No population numbers have been recorded, but it seems the middling souls consigned to pass through this place must make up the majority of human beings. We who regret our worst habits but not quite enough to change them before time runs out. Dante, fresh from hell and feeling low, asks if his friend would be able to sing one of the love songs that used to soothe him. No one seems to know the rules yet. What's allowed, how long the wait, how much pain one has earned. In response, the man begins to sing a poem of Dante's, with such ease that it seems he must have said it back at home. His voice is exceptionally sweet, and until the guard comes along, yelling and hurrying everybody on, we forget where we are, and there is nothing but the song. And now, from the December 5th, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, are we getting stupider? Stupidity is eternal and more complex than we think, by Joshua Rothman. A couple of weeks ago, I was at the gym, exercising and musing about an upcoming column, when one of the kids from the front desk ran up to me. "Did you put a lock on a locker?" he asked. I said that I had, and instantly realized that, in a moment of inattention, I had accidentally padlocked the locker next to the one where I'd stored my stuff. We dashed to the locker room, where a man around my age was bouncing impatiently from foot to foot. His belongings were trapped behind my lock. "Dude, I'm really late," he said. In a fugue state of embarrassment and remorse, I squinted at my padlock. I had my contacts in and couldn't make out the combination. "Can you read this?" I asked him inanely before simply clawing my contacts out. I opened the lock and then stepped aside so that he could grab his things and bolt for the door. I felt stupid, obviously, so stupid that afterward I could barely concentrate on the heavy weights I was lifting. That could have led to another stupid mistake. Thankfully, a few minutes later, my mood shifted when it occurred to me that I could use the incident to start my column. That's how stupidity often is, causing problems, but also presenting opportunities. My stupid act had been a useful one, at least to me. To put it differently, I had discovered that I was smart enough to make something out of having been dumb. Stupidity is surprising. This is the main idea in A Short History of Stupidity by the accomplished British critic Stuart Jeffries. It's easy to be stupid about stupidity, Jeffries argues, to assume that we know what counts as stupid and who is acting stupidly. Stupidity is, more than anything else, familiar. Jeffries quotes Arthur Schopenhauer, who wrote that the wise in all ages have always said the same thing, and the fools, who at all times form the immense majority, have, in their way too, acted alike and done just the opposite. And so it will continue. But it's also the case, in Jeffrey's view, that stupidity evolves, that it mutates and thereby eludes extinction. It's possible to write a history of stupidity only because new kinds of stupidity are always being invented. Jeffries begins in antiquity with the ancient Greek philosophers who distinguished between being ignorant, which was perfectly normal and not all that shameful, and being stupid, which involved an unwillingness to acknowledge and attempt to overcome one's ultimately insurmountable cognitive and empirical limitations. A non-stupid person, from this perspective, is someone who's open to walking a path of self-humiliation from unknowing ignorance to self-conscious ignorance. He might even welcome that experience, seeing it as the start of a longer journey of learning. To maintain this good attitude, it's helpful to remember that stupidity is often domain-specific. Even if we're stupid in some areas of life, Jeffries notes, we're capable in others. Today, we still object to what might be called Socratic stupidity. We're appalled, for instance, by Donald Trump going over the heads of his scientific advisors to suggest that injections of disinfectants might treat COVID. And yet, many other kinds of stupidity endure. Jeffries explores Eastern stupidity. In his telling, Buddhists warn of the wrongheadedness that can emerge from pointless and ego-driven intellectual argument. And Renaissance stupidity. For Shakespeare, folly could be a mask behind which true wisdom conceals itself. The notion that folly, and perhaps even stupidity, are desirable has often been incendiary, Jeffries writes, and yet it persists in our sense that true cleverness might involve a mixture of smarts and stupidity, the latter acting as an antidote to the blindness of reason. For 19th century writers like Gustave Flaubert, the concept of stupidity came to encompass the lazy drivel of cliché and received opinion. One of Flaubert's characters says that, in mass society, the germs of stupidity spread from person to person, and we end up becoming lemming-like followers of leaders, trends, and fads. This modern stupidity, Jeffries explains, is hastened by urbanization. The more dense a population is in one sense, the more dense it is in another. And the 20th and 21st centuries have seen further innovations. We're now conscious of the kinds of stupidity that might reveal themselves through intelligence tests or boneheaded bureaucracies. We know about BS jobs and the banality of evil and digital inundation. Jeffries considers a light fixture in his bedroom. It has a recessed design that's hard to figure out. So he goes to YouTube in search of videos that might show him how to change the bulb. Modern, high-tech life is complicated. And so, yes, in a broad sense, we may very well be getting stupider. Not necessarily because we're dumber, but because the ways in which we can be stupid keep multiplying. A short history of stupidity doesn't always engage with the question of whether the multiplication of stupidities is substantive or rhetorical. When Flaubert writes that people today are drowning in cliché and received opinion, is he right? Is it actually true that, before newspapers, individuals held more diverse and original views? Well, that seems unlikely. The general trend over the past few hundred years has been toward more education for more people. Flaubert may very well have been exposed to more stupid thoughts, but this could have reflected the fact that more thoughts were being shared. Arguably, by railing against the stupidity of cliché, Flaubert was actually practicing a form of self-humiliation. That is, he was asking himself whether he agreed with the clichés, and so goading himself and us into being non-stupid. In his satirical Dictionary of Received Ideas, written in the 1870s, Flaubert offered up a range of definitions embodying the stupid notions that silly people too readily accept. Jeffries likes art. Leads to poorhouse. What use is it, since machines can do things better and quicker? My wife and I always laugh about Bird. Wish you were one, sang with a sigh. Oh, for a pair of wings. This shows you have a poetic soul. It's natural for such thoughts to occur to us. Stupidity is the product of the groups and societies in which we are raised, Jeffries explains, referencing the philosopher Sacha Golub. By mocking these thoughts, we push ourselves past them. From this perspective, our sense that we're getting stupider may simply reflect our determination to be smart. And yet, it seems undeniable that something is out of joint in our collective intellectual life. The current political situation makes this a good time to write about stupidity, Jeffries writes. When he notes that a central trait of stupidity is that it can be relied upon to do the one thing expressly designed not to achieve the desired result or to laughably mismatch ends and means. He makes stupid seem like the perfect way to characterize our era, in which many people think that the key to making America healthy again is ending vaccination. Meanwhile, in a recent issue of New York Magazine, The Stupid Issue, the journalist Andrew Rice describes troubling and widespread declines in the abilities of high school students to perform basic tasks, such as calculating a tip on a restaurant check. These declines are happening even in well-funded school districts, and they are part of a larger academic pattern in which literacy is fading and standards are slipping. Maybe we are getting stupider. Still, one of the problems with the discourse of stupidity is that it can feel reductive, aggressive, even abusive. Self-humiliation is still humiliating. When we call one another stupid, we spread humiliation around, whether our accusation is just or unjust. In a recent post on Substack, the philosopher Joseph Heath suggested that populism might be best understood as a revolt against the cognitive elite. That is, against the people who demand that we check our intuitions and think more deliberately about pretty much everything. According to this theory, the world constructed by the cognitive elite is one in which you have to listen to experts and keep up with technology and click through 6 pages of online forms to buy a movie ticket. It sometimes requires the typical person, while speaking, to actively suppress the familiar word that is primed, for example, homelessness, and to substitute through explicit cognition the recently minted word that is now favored, unhoused. The cognitive elites are right to say that people who think about things intuitively are often wrong. On issues including crime and immigration, the truth is counterintuitive. Legal procedures are better than rough justice. Immigrants increase both the supply and the demand for labor. But the result of this has been that unreasonable people have hooked up to form an opposition party. What's the way out of this death spiral? No one knows. In 1970, a dead sperm whale washed up on the beach in Florence, Oregon. It was huge, and no one knew how to dispose of it. Eventually, the state's highway division, which was in charge of the operation, hit upon the idea of blowing the carcass up with dynamite. They planted 0.5 ton of explosive, that's a lot, on the leeward side of the whale, figuring that what wasn't blown out to sea would disintegrate into bits small enough to be consumed by crabs and seagulls. Onlookers gathered to watch the explosion. It failed to destroy the whale and instead created a dangerous hailstorm of putrid whale fragments. "I realized blubber was hitting around us," Paul Lindman, a reporter on the scene, told Popular Mechanics magazine. "Blubber is so dense, a piece the size of your fingertip can go through your head." As we started to run down the trail, we heard a second explosion in our direction, and we saw blubber the size of a coffee table flatten a car. The video of the incident, which was first popularized by Dave Barry after he wrote about it in 1990, is a treasure of the internet and benefits from Lindman's deadpan TV news narration. There can be joy and humor in stupidity. Think fail videos, reality television, and Dumb and Dumber. It doesn't have to be mean-spirited either. The town of Florence now boasts an outdoor space called Exploding Whale Memorial Park. Last year, after a week-long celebration leading up to Exploding Whale Day, people gathered there in costume. Watching the original video, I find myself empathizing with the engineer who conceived the dynamite plan. I've been there. To err is human. Intelligent people sometimes do stupid things. We all blow up a whale from time to time. The important point is not to do it again. And yet, stupidity, sadly, isn't always so straightforward. It's a concept that demands nuance. In order to be smart, we need to be aware of our own stupidness, to be reminded that we have much to learn. At the same time, we don't want to feel so stupid that we give up or grow cynical or become disillusioned about what counts as smart. Similarly, navigating the world effectively requires discerning stupidity in others, but living together involves understanding that stupidity is inevitable and context-dependent. There's some ideal degree of stupidity consciousness, some measured amount that protects us from hubris while urging us forward. Achieving it is not easy. And I'll end, as usual, with some poetry. First, from the November 24th, 2025 issue, Senescence by D.A. Powell. Just as I come to know a thing, it's gone again. What's in my heartwood, in my head? Brashy, ashy, friable, crumbled colors. Dormancy of matter, of leaf, an orderly degradation. I have come to measure the dark, not just the frost and not the lack of light, the uninterrupted dark of which the winter is a small part. A contraction of the corona, catch in the windpipe of the old organ, organ of the old windpipe, pipe of the pileated woodpecker pecking a whole hole in me. Yellow, orange, brown. The greens break down, the chloroplasts depart. Each leaf losing its factories from the outside in, its faculties, I seem to mean, from edge to artery, the last gold somewhere in a vein of no use now. Abscission is a nice way to say the natural cutting off of things. A wounded limb where leaf scar gives way to bud scale. Safeguard, night nurse, attending orderly of the tender leaf below. It comes again, the ascent of spring, first leaf, first bloom, first fiddle of the fiddle fern. I hated to lose the light, right when the frost and the xanthophyll make shatter lightning so plentiful, wind shaking the old boughs, timbre style. I do not gentle into any one leaves and another moves in, new twigs, new nest, sometimes a whole new tree in another life, in another fall, from another book, in another tongue, and what world, this one, maybe the last page torn off so it can't be read. So it cannot happen, have happened, yet. And now, from the December 1st, 2025 issue, Letter in April by Marie T. Martin. Do you still receive letters from the dead? I'm writing you in the year after your death, without eyes. What do you see? Here, the blue bean shrub and glimmer weed grow, later revealing themselves. Which sentences would have been important? Do you still write letters? I'm writing to myself the year I was born, a painted scroll unfurled in a parking lot, the calligraphy of tires. Have you gotten older? Does the passing subway car see you? Does the maple tree hold you in between? Promise me you'll stay awake. Promise me a speech for the soul in an arrangement of white hawthorn and juniper. Promise me you'll wake. Promise me never to leave you. And now, from the December 1st, 2025 issue, The Terrible Various by Diane Seuss. Blossoming of the trees, she said to herself, sloshing unshod through the snow water. This was the nature of her humor, the wilderness she aspired to. Mostly, it was a way of seeing that did not resort to sentence making. Note the religious poses of roadkill, for instance, at the instant of their death most terribly holy, and so to walk the roads was tantamount to sloshing through the gas stations of the cross. From the November 24th, 2025 issue, The Loved Ones by Wendell Berry. The loved ones we call the dead depart from us and for a while are absent. And then, as if called back by our love, they come near us again. They enter our dreams. We feel they have been near us when we have not thought of them. They are simply here, simply waiting while we are distracted among our obligations. At last it comes to us. They live now in the permanent world. We are the absent ones. And finally, from the best jokes of 2025, This Is Your Mother Calling. The comedian Emily Catalano told a perfect joke in 2024, but it made the rounds this year. My mom called me today at 3 p.m., and the first thing she said to me was, "Did I wake you?" Have you ever gotten a metaphorical and literal wake-up call at the exact same time? We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.